When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. Well, let's get into the mystery case. Now, what we do here, you guys have listened to our podcast recently. We do a mystery case before we get into the bulk of the podcast. And sometimes if the case is long enough, we'll split them up into a separate podcast. I've been doing that for folks, attention spans being what they are. But yeah, it's a mystery case. It's a real case. It's published in the medical literature. And I tried to go through it in a way that allows us to peer into Austin's clinical brain, like what he thinks about when he sees a patient. And he takes us through step by step his thought process, and I think it could be useful. We talk about some clinical pearls at the end. But again, this is a real case, really happened. And if you want to play along at home, whenever I ask Dr. Baraki for his thoughts, his assessment, click pause and come up with your own sort of assessment, see how close you are. Again, there are no wrong answers here until the very end. So you can say whatever you want. But when I ask for the final diagnosis, that's like final answer on, what was it, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? You know, mm-hmm. You got to lock it in. And then and then at that point, then there is a right and a wrong answer. So last thing there is for me to do here is to predict whether or not you're going to get this. Again, I should just say that you're going to get it. But I don't know, this particular case, and it has nothing to do with the history, the amount of labs or whatever. I just think this is a harder than normal case, and I think we might stump you. So let's get into it. 36-year-old man presents to the hospital as a direct admission from his rheumatologist for worsening weakness over the last 5 months. 5 months ago, the patient started noticing reduced muscle strength, making it hard to walk, climb stairs, or even stand. Over the last few weeks, it's gotten even worse, and he now requires a wheelchair, which prompted the referral and direct admission from his rheumatologist. When he saw the rheumatologist, he was diagnosed with dermatomyositis due to muscle weakness and a, quote, heliotrope rash, according to the rheumatologist. Now, dermatomyositis is a disease where inflammation, likely of autoimmune origin, causes muscle weakness and usually characteristic skin findings, like a rash around the eyes, raised bumps on the joints of the hand, and so on. He's been treated with a steroid, prednisolone, and azathioprine, which is an immunosuppressant. He has no personal or family medical history. He denies trauma, any recent weight loss, no fevers, or recreational drug use. So before we go on to the physical exam and some laboratory findings, any thoughts?
Yeah, so this 36-year-old patient, pretty unfortunate story that he's had progressive, you know, seemingly pretty symmetric, if not generalized, weakness over the course of 5 months. So definitely in more of the chronic kind of weakness territory. And as we've discussed previously, when I think about weakness, one of the things I think about is it focal, or is it in like a particular limb, like a left leg or a right arm, in which case we tend to think about a lot of either local traumatic issues, but also like neurologic problems starting from the brain, right? Going from the outer part of the brain to the deeper parts of the brain, the brainstem, the spinal cord, the spinal nerves, all the way out to the neuromuscular junction and the muscle itself. But in this situation, at least per the previous rheumatologist's assessment, which we may, you know, pull into question here, was really localized more to the muscles themselves, not so much a neurological disease or a neuromuscular disease, but the muscles themselves. Dealing with this autoimmune inflammatory condition. It's a type of inflammatory myopathy or inflammatory myositis where the immune system is basically attacking his own muscles. It can also attack the skin, which can lead to the dermato part of dermatomyositis. So you can get skin findings and muscle findings. There's also all sorts of permutations of this where you can get dermatomyositis without skin problems, dermatomyositis without muscle problems. You can get more severe cases of it that can really destroy your lungs really aggressively. And so, you know, at this point, I don't have a ton of information or reason to question the rheumatologist diagnosis. I suspect I'll need some more information to start taking me down a different path, but this patient seems to have progressive disease despite getting treated with glucocorticoids like his prednisolone, as well as a different immunosuppressant, a non-steroid immunosuppressant like azathioprine. Now, if we are very confident in this diagnosis of dermatomyositis, be it by tissue biopsy, serologies like his blood antibody test, et cetera, then the situation would be we need to augment his immunosuppression with other more potent agents, biologics and certain other things that is well beyond the territory of an internist to make those kind of decisions, but just recognizing a patient who's not responding to the current treatment. But what is within our territory is to say, when this patient's getting sent in, is there an alternative explanation for why his weakness is progressing, why he appears to not be responding to this treatment? Is there a second issue? Is there an infection going on because he has this immunosuppression? Is there some underlying cancer? And this is like paraneoplastic dermatomyositis that, you know, he doesn't have the actual underlying cause being treated. So there's a lot of possibilities there, but I just need a little bit more information, I guess, coming up soon to make me question the rheumatologist diagnosis to pull me in a different direction, why I would want to override that or look in a different direction than they already have.
Yeah. So before we get into the physical exam and some laboratory findings, you know, one question here is, when, especially for our healthcare professionals in training, is, you know, you get conditioned and told to and sort of pushed to, you know, ask consultants for to weigh in on a case, whether it's endocrinology, whether it's oncology, you know, all the different specialties can be tapped for various questions. But what I found, especially in my own training, it was like a turning point. I would just, you know, consult a one of these specialties whenever I had a patient that kind of would fall under their purview. But a lot of times initially in my training, I wouldn't actually have a question for them. It'd be like, hey, you want to just take a look and like make sure we're not like screwing it up? And I think, you know, that has to do with not only the education level, but also comfort in, you know, sort of managing some of these cases that maybe do fall under a specialist sort of purview. So if you get a direct admission from another specialty, you know, how do you take that under consideration? You know, I assume this has something to do with like the extensive, you know, how extensive the workup was, how confident we are in this finding. You're like, yeah, this seems reasonable. Or you're like, I kind of wish I didn't know. I wish this patient was undifferentiated and I just got to figure it out on my own. Like, where do you fall on that?
Yeah, this sometimes happens where a specialist might, you know, send a patient in and because they might not themselves have admitting privileges or be the person who admits patients to their own service in the hospital, then they might ask me to. And when I get the story from them, I might just get a sense of, hey, what do you know about this person? And what is the purpose of this admission? Like, what are we trying to accomplish? What are we trying to address, deal with, so that I have the right frame of reference for this patient? And then, you know, if they're like, sometimes, you know, it's very clear that the specialist is like, here's what's going on with this patient. Here's what I'm worried about. Here's what we need to do while they're here in the hospital. Can you help us get that done? And it's very simple. And I'll say, sure, I'll do that. Other times a specialist might be sending somebody in and they're like, I don't know what this is, but I don't think it's in my specialty bucket. Maybe it's in somebody else's specialty bucket. Can you help me like figure out where, you know, where this problem is coming from or what's going on? Cause I'm not sure, but I don't think it's my organ as a specialist who might be dealing with one particular organ. So those are the two scenarios. And I'm obviously happy to help with either if I can, in which case I will do a similar type of exercise as we're doing here. I will go and take my own history on the patient, get a sense of what they've been dealing with, what the time course is, try to summarize the case, and then launch into my own thought process along the way and kind of guide the evaluation as I would with any other patient, whether or not they had been sent in by a specialist.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's get into the physical exam and some labs for you. So first off, vitals are pretty normal. They are significant for an elevated blood pressure to 145 over 90, but otherwise unremarkable. On exam, the patient appears anxious, but is well nourished. His eye exam is within normal limits. His musculoskeletal exam, on the other hand, is significant for decreased strength to 4 out of 5 in the shoulder girdle. Also, his arms are 4 out of 5, and then 3 out of 5 in the proximal thigh. Now, for the listeners at home, especially if you're not a healthcare professional or if you're a healthcare professional in training, we rate sort of muscular function on this scale from 0 to 5, and there are sort of well-accepted terms or definitions for each sort of rating, although if we have neurologists listening to this, they tend to get a little bit more detailed. So just an overview, a rating of 0 out of 5 is effectively no muscle activation, and 5 out of 5 is muscle activation against the examiner's full resistance with full range of motion. And so there are various sort of permutations of this in the middle. So 4 out of 5 in his upper extremities means muscle activation against some resistance, full range of motion, but this is a decidedly or frankly weak individual. And 3 out of 5 is even weaker than that. So you wouldn't just rate somebody, you know, who has relatively normal muscular function, but is like not as strong as you or I at 4 out of 5, there'd be a frank sort of weakness that you'd be able to detect on exam. And, you know, I know some neurologists that I've trained under, they do, you know, ratings plus and minus and stuff like that to try to get a little more specific. That's a little bit beyond the scope. And I don't pretend to be an expert in their specific ratings. But when you have medical students or residents on your service, and they say, oh, yeah, this patient's got 4 out of 5 strength, do you launch into some sort of, you know, discussion about what this actually means? Or how do you kind of conceptualize that?
No, I put relatively little stock when it's reported to me in that way. I think what I find in general among the trainees that I work with is that they are reluctant to put sufficient force into their patients when they're doing strength testing. And so they are more likely to actually falsely rate a patient's strength as good when there might actually be a more subtle side-to-side difference. And that's just because they didn't try hard enough. And so it's sometimes when I go and I might repeat an exam and show them, like, hey, here's how I'm going to test this patient's, like, you know, elbow flexion strength. And I put one arm up against their shoulder and I'm pulling like very hard against their wrist. And the students, they might get like apprehensive or scared at like actually how hard I'm pulling, because they can recognize that I am capable of generating a fair amount of force, let's say, right? And I'm like trying to break the patient's strength, right? And so the more force that I'm able to put in, I will then have a better sensitivity to detect more subtle side-to-side differences. Whereas, for example, in flip the scenario, say a student or a trainee who is not as strong as I am is trying to do strength testing on me. If I'm stronger than they are, then if I had a side-to-side strength difference, they might not be able to detect it because even my weak side might be stronger than they are. And so I'm trying to make the case that, like, you need to make the patient work pretty hard if you want to get a sensitive kind of strength exam in these situations. So that's the more common problem that I see among trainees.
Yeah, maybe we could come up with a minimal strength needed as a clinician to be able to adequately test the musculoskeletal system. But in any case, this patient, as far as we know, his blood pressure is elevated. Otherwise, it seems fine, minus his muscle weakness, all right? So he has some frank muscle weakness symmetrically, both his upper limbs and lower extremities. His deep tendon reflexes are reduced in the biceps, triceps, and the patellar reflex to 1 out of 2. And again, there's another scale here. If you want to look that up, I've linked a resource in the description below for how reflexes are rated. But 2 out of 2 would be sort of normal. 2+ would be normal, whereas something like 3+ or 4+ would be brisk, or even like a repeating reflex that's pathological or otherwise not normal. And a 0 out of 2 would be none at all. Okay, moving on. There are no skin findings, no rash of note on exam. We move into his laboratory findings. The significant for a white count, white blood cell count to 12.6. Some mild anemia, 12.8, with an MCV of 103. His blood chemistry is normal. Liver function tests are within normal limits. His LDH, lactate dehydrogenase, is 658, which is elevated. It's normal for there is 140 to 280. His ESR, erythrocyte sedimentation rate, and CRP, C-reactive protein, those are both normal. It has a complete rheumatology workup. So all of the you know, antibodies that you would expect to find in this rheumatology sort of workup, those are all within normal limits. Now, I'm going to give you some imaging before I ask you to weigh in on this. All right, his chest X-ray was unremarkable. Had an abdominal and pelvic ultrasound, which was also unremarkable. Had an MRI of his lumbar spine that showed multi-level pathological fracture, most notable in L3, and also severe atrophy of the paraspinal muscles, according to the radiologist's read. Had a brain CT done as well that showed a round, well-defined mass measuring 30 by 12 millimeters in the cellar region, that's where the pituitary gland sits, with extension towards the optic chiasma and invasion of the surrounding areas. Also had EMG and nerve conduction studies done that showed decreased velocity in impulse conduction. So I know I gave you a lot there, all right? You want to summarize and maybe give some additional thoughts about this patient and what you're thinking?
Yeah, you gave me an enormous amount of information, I will say.
Well, I wanted to give you enough to actually opine eloquently here on some stuff.
Okay. So to summarize, we have this 36-year-old guy, maybe thought to have dermatomyositis in the past, immunosuppressed, on steroids and azathioprine, coming in with worsening progressive muscle weakness for 5 months. There's some discrepancy. You told me he's like, you know, reduced to being in a wheelchair, yet his strength exam actually showed better strength than I would expect for somebody who is stuck in a wheelchair, but that is what it is. He is confirmed to have some proximal muscle weakness. The fact that his reflexes are reduced doesn't do a ton for me. It can be indicative of a neurological problem, but to have brisk reflexes, you need muscles to be able to contract strongly to generate that reflex. So if his muscle strength is down, you can have kind of a false reduction in your reflex response. So I'm unclear on what to make of that. And then his labs, you know, the white blood cell count being elevated, just not very a specific finding. We can see it in inflammation. We can see it in infections. You know, we can also see it in patients who are on steroids, which he is. And so I'm not making a ton out of that at the moment. And then the hemoglobin, you know, patients with chronic inflammation, they can have a mild anemias, and that's not terribly bad either. So then as far as the rest of his labs go, one thing that I was waiting to hear that you didn't give me was a creatine kinase level or some marker of muscle breakdown, since we're worried about myositis in this patient. You gave me the LDH, which is elevated, and an LDH, kind of like a CK, which I think I mentioned on the last case, can just come out of any cells that are getting injured, ruptured. So if somebody has myositis or myopathy or rhabdo or something like that, as the muscle cells are getting broken down, CK will get released, LDH will get released along with it. So that would not be surprising. I suspect that that is probably the cause of that.
If you wanted a creatine kinase level, unfortunately, I don't have one for you, but in this patient, it would be elevated.
It would be elevated, as would, I imagine, his AST, because you told me his liver enzymes are normal, and AST is also an enzyme that comes out of muscle cells when they get broken down.
Yes, so they are not, though. That I can confirm are not.
Okay, cool. So then we move on, and you gave me what we're summarizing as, quote unquote, the rheumatologic workup, which is a whole lot of antibody testing. Interpretation of these antibodies can be pretty complex, and some antibodies are much more useful than others, depending on the context. I'm just going to grant you that, hey, all of them were negative, including the antibodies that would be more specific for dermatomyositis, of which there are certainly some that would be expected to be positive. But if they're negative now, that's interesting and makes me wonder, were they ever positive in the past, or were we diagnosing some kind of, you know, weird variety that was seronegative dermatomyositis or something like that?
Any specific serologies that you would be you're curious about? I can give you the exact value if you prefer.
I mean, you're telling me they're negative. I don't know that I want to pepper you,
sure.
But his ANA, and then subsequent kind of ANA cascade would involve a bunch of other antibodies, including like a Joe and numerous other ones that would be related to, for example, polymyositis. There's certain other ones that are more particular for dermatomyositis and other kind of inflammatory myopathies.
Yeah,
all the ones that you want
DNA. That's right. Yeah, all of them are within normal limits. Yes.
Okay. All right. So now the imaging seems to be where we have the most signal for like some pretty significant abnormalities. His chest, abdomen, pelvis. Unclear why they did an ultrasound of his pelvis, but that's what it is. And then so we see a 36-year-old guy with multi-level pathological fractures in his lumbar spine. So one possibility is he has osteoporosis, right? And then you'd have to question, why does he have osteoporosis? The most obvious reason could be from him being on steroids, depending on how long he's been on these steroids, how much of a dose. I don't get the sense that he's been on them for like years and years and years. And so
5 months.
Yeah, not enough.
5 milligram. Yeah.
Yeah, not enough to cause this. And so I'm wondering, why does he have these fractures if I'm not attributing it to him being on steroids? So next, we see this severe atrophy of the paraspinal muscles, also a bit weird, and then a pretty large, I would say, mass in the region adjacent or around the pituitary gland. So you said 30 by 12 millimeters, so 3 centimeters by like 1.2 in that area, with some invasion into the surrounding areas, if I recall you mentioning, right? And so I'm not an expert in pituitary masses outside of things like macroadenomas and craniopharyngiomas. And of course, you can get meningiomas and certain other types of tumors in that area. The invasion into surrounding areas is something that would be concerning for maybe a more malignant process, some kind of carcinoma or some kind of malignancy in the area. The question that I have is this causing basically other consequences as a result of impairing pituitary function? So, for example, does this mass that is in the region of the pituitary, seemingly pretty aggressive and invasive, compromising his pituitary function? So he is, you know, kind of not operating with the healthy, normal amount of pituitary hormones. Those hormones would include things like thyroid stimulating hormone, such that he doesn't make enough thyroid hormone. And I suppose you could get a thyroid myopathy from something like that as one example. ACTH coming from that kind of territory, getting secreted and stick signaling downstream to generate cortisol from the adrenal glands. So you can get adrenal insufficiency. I can say for sure he does not have adrenal insufficiency based on the fact that he has high blood pressure and his chemistry is normal. So that one is off the table. Another possibility, GnRH comes from the hypothalamus and stimulates the pituitary to secrete LH and FSH, which would stimulate his testes to generate testosterone. Could he have severe hypogonadism, which can cause male osteoporosis, and I suppose some muscle weakness and things like that, so and anemia, which he has. So could this mass be compromising his kind of gonadal axis, leading to just like horrifically severe hypogonadism, to leaving him wheelchair bound? That's a bit of a stretch, but I suppose, you know, if I saw a young guy with osteoporosis, hypogonadism is actually one of the things that I'm kind of worried about, aside from parathyroid related issues and steroids and things like that. So there's just a few examples off the top of my head of things that come from the pituitary that could tie into some of the presenting aspects of this case that could be compromised if he has a weird mass in that area. As far as what I would do next, I mean, this mass was visualized apparently on brain CT, which is not the best imaging modality to look at that kind of thing. So I'd want to get a dedicated MRI of the cella and talk to a neuroradiologist about what that looks like. And then from there, potentially talk to a neurosurgeon about, hey, does this thing need biopsy? Or is this like completely incidental and something that looks totally benign to you that you would not worry about? In which case, that would steer me in a different direction. And then in the meantime, I would also just tack on as an aside, just basic like osteoporosis type workup. What's this guy's calcium, vitamin D, PTH, urinary calcium, stuff like that, to get a sense of why does he have these issues going on in his bones. And then, because interestingly, I mean, you mentioned that his ESR and CRP are normal. He doesn't have concrete, obvious evidence of severe active inflammation going on. So I'm wondering, if he doesn't have a severe raging inflammatory process, I'm looking in a different direction than dermatomyositis to try to explain some of these findings. So that's kind of where I am right now. This is a pretty nebulous case, but pretty interesting.
Hey guys, it's Jordan with Barbell Medicine. Summer is here, and that means a lot of you are going to want to spend more time outside and less time on meal prep, all while staying on track with your nutrition. For many, a meal prep service like Factor can bridge that gap. Now, I've been using Factor for a while now, just here and there when I'm spending more time away from home or don't have time to cook, and it's made my day delicious and easy. Meals are ready in just 2 minutes, and they have everything from breakfast to dinner and even dessert, so you can stay fueled with easy, nutritious options. They also have 35 different meals and more than 60 add-ons. I am a creature of habit, but there's a lot of different stuff to choose from, so you'll always have new flavors to explore. So head to factormeals.com/BBM50 and use code BBM50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month. That's code BBM50 at factormeals.com/BBM50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is active.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah, well, let's get you some of that hormone data and stuff that you were kind of alluding to. So the main findings on this kind of pan endocrine workup, all right, the main findings were that he was severely hypogonadal, low FSH, low LH, despite a total testosterone level of 44, which is markedly low. Again, for most labs, the normal range, you know, stops at about 300, and below that is frankly low, and he's 44. Also has low T4, low T3, although these are more modest reductions, and a normal TSH at present. Is a dexamethasone suppression test, which is primarily used to screen for excess cortisol production. They typically give the patient a steroid, in this case dexamethasone, and then measure the cortisol the following morning. It should be low, as the steroid should suppress the pituitary gland and subsequent production of cortisol. Well, his AM cortisol while on prednisolone, was 295, which is high. And his ACTH was 222, which is extremely high. Normal is 46. All right. Also has some other findings like an elevated prolactin and a low fasting growth hormone. But at this particular point, while we're waiting on the neuroradiologist to kind of weigh in on the brain MRI, you do have enough to make a diagnosis. And so I will ask you to make a diagnosis that ties all of these symptoms and findings together.
Yeah. Okay.
You can also ask me a question and I will try to answer it based on the publishing in the case report. Now, to be clear, the problem with case reports is that there's like a word limit usually.
Sure,
and
sure.
So it's not always possible to kind of go through the mystery case and arrive at an answer. I'm getting you off the hook here, but we'll see if you have some questions and maybe if you can make the correct diagnosis.
Yeah. So the interpretation of some of this is a bit tricky, but it seems like I was certainly on the right track with the hormone related concerns in the pituitary gland. And I agree, a total testosterone of 44 is effectively zero in my mind. And the reductions in FSH and LH are indicative that this is secondary hypogonadism or testosterone deficiency due to a problem at the level of the pituitary or potentially the hypothalamus. But here we have an obvious reason why. Thyroid hormones, again, mildly deranged. And then that suppression test, there's some complicated aspects of that in terms of I'm very interested that they actually did that test up front and complicated to interpret in somebody who's already on steroids, but particularly prednisolone. But to your point, it seems like the combination of the fact that his blood cortisol is way too high and his ACTH is very elevated means that the ACTH is inappropriately high, right? So it should be suppressed when you're taking a steroid. And so that means that ACTH is being inappropriately produced, and that inappropriate ACTH production is then stimulating excessive cortisol production. And so then that excessive cortisol production is functionally probably contributing along with the testosterone deficiency to his osteoporosis and weakness and things like and basically non-inflammatory myopathy is what he has as far as the muscle weakness and things like that. Now, as far as the diagnosis kind of what is going on in his brain, when the ACTH is coming from a basically excessive production from the pituitary gland, we call that Cushing disease, which is a particular type of Cushing's syndrome. And so I'm wondering, you know, does this guy have Cushing disease from what could be like a pituitary macroadenoma? And that macroadenoma is compressing and impairing pituitary function in other ways, leading to these other hormone derangements. The only side kind of consideration here is if this thing is actually, as you mentioned, like aggressive, invasive, getting into other structures in the area, is it not just a benign pituitary macroadenoma, but potentially a pituitary adenocarcinoma, meaning it is malignant, cancerous, which is very uncommon. So an adenocarcinoma of the area that is also active, hot, secreting ACTH, leading to Cushing disease, as well as compromising his gonadal function. So I think that's about as far as I can get right now with the information provided.
Yeah, great job. The Cushing's disease causing hypercortisolism, ACTH secreting tumor. He was treated with a transphenoidal microadenectomy. So basically they went in there and surgerized this guy, cut out the mass to the best of their extent. And he was started on levothyroxine and some TRT. The muscle weakness did improve. And after 2 months, he could walk with a walker. Now I know with the listeners at home are saying like, what do you mean he just didn't get like better all the way? Well, at this point, he had an additional MRI, brain MRI, that was performed. It showed another mass in the pituitary gland, and he failed another cortisol suppression test. So he was resurgerized, and they cut out some more, and he recovered full strength by 1 year post-op of his second operation. He was on thyroid medications, on TRT, on a bone mineral density medication, alendronate, and some other supplements to kind of keep him on the straight and narrow, because effectively he had severe compromise of his pituitary function from this mass. But yeah, recovered full strength at a year.
Fascinating. Super bad luck for him to have this twice. And yeah, that's a very pretty remarkable story. Kind of embarrassing that it was initially diagnosed as dermatomyositis. I'm not clear how you ever get there up front without serologic, you know, markers, inflammatory markers. But, you know, these things happen. If you had a classic appearing rash and the muscle weakness, then maybe, I guess. But managing patients who've had, if he ever needed like his whole pituitary taken out, is complicated because, you know, pituitary gland, we all take for granted. I've had some patients before with basically what's called panhypopituitarism. Their entire pituitary gland is out, dead, resected, radiated, whatever. And the amount of work that it actively takes to manage most of your hormones without your body doing it by itself is very tricky. appreciate your pituitary gland.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Yeah. Don't try to do its work, its job for it. It's smarter than you are. It's better than you are. Like it's great.
Yeah.
As far as some clinical pearls here, I mean, this is myopathy, you know, and that's just a broad, a type of myopathy, which is many different causes. But overall, these are disorders that affect the skeletal muscles, specifically the way they function due to a change in their structure, metabolism, or how they contract in response to electrical signaling. Now, symptoms are typically weakness, stiffness, spasms, and cramps. And again, there are many different causes of myopathy. And on next week's episode, we're going to talk about just one of them, which is having too much cortisol in your system. That's kind of the case here, hypercortisolism from a ACTH secreting tumor. So we'll talk about that on next week's podcast. But before we do that, before we get into the great debates section, Austin, do you have some sort of like mental algorithm for our audience about when they should be worried about muscle weakness and see a doctor versus when they should just shrug it off? I mean, I can imagine some people in here that are thinking, you know, I was not quite as strong as I expected to be on my squats today. For example, like, do I have Cushing's disease? Is there some sort of like, a mental shortcut that you could kind of convey to our audience?
Yeah, I guess it would be similar to the advice that I gave on a previous episode about injury and pain. If it's this like weakness that is unexpected, disproportionate, unilateral, or progressive, just to come off the top of my head with a few examples of things. So when I say disproportionate, it means I am like way, way, way weaker than I would expect. And this isn't like, oh, my deadlift went from 660 down to 600, because I've described having like a 10% drop in strength like that before. But rather, like, I went from being able to walk normally to like my, you know, I'm falling because my right leg can't like bear my weight normally or something like that, right? If it's progressive weakness, that's getting worse and worse and worse over time, to the point where you are noticing maybe more compromise in normal functions. Like normally I could grip and hold these things, and now I'm having trouble gripping or holding up my coffee mug or something like that. Right. If it's one side or the other, if it's, you know, particularly if it's acute, then like maybe you're having a stroke and you should be worried about that. Right. Mm-hmm. So those are just a few examples off the top of my head of scenarios that would really get my attention. But if it's just like, I trained really hard last week and my strength performance like dipped a little bit, but otherwise I'm able to go about my life otherwise normally, that's not a reason to be concerned.
Yeah. I generally think that if the only place you're noticing some sort of deficit is in the gym in general, those deficits are probably not like medically caused. It's not impossible. And I could think of some subtle sort of decrease in strength that are due to a medical condition, but usually they need to declare themselves at a higher level where some activity of daily life or other, you know, recreational pursuit is significantly compromised. And you're like, oh, this particular condition has declared itself, that requires some sort of workup. But yeah, if your squat, your deadlift, something like that is down 10%, even 20% really, like, that's not outside the realm of, you know, possibilities, depending on what else is going on. But that doesn't really raise an alarm bell compared to like, yeah, I'm having trouble like holding a cup.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Or like my coordination is severely off. I can't, you know, feed myself comfortably, for example. And obviously that's an extreme example. People are like, yeah, no kidding, I should see a doctor. And I'm like, that's kind of how I feel about this. You know, if you're at the point where you're like, duh, see a doctor, you're like, yeah, you should do that. So, all right, cool case. Great job. Again, I should have never doubted you, but in reading the case report, I was like, there's not enough information as far as like how it unravels itself to really make a definitive, confident diagnosis, but you got there. And I don't know if I help lead you there. Maybe I gave you a little.
One day you'll believe in me.
Yeah, one day I'll have confidence in your diagnostic skills. Before you guys go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. From everyone here at Barbell Medicine, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. We'll catch you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Fall into big savings, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with your card and a digital coupon. Then buy one, get one free on our full line sale of tender Tyson chicken with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.